Hey, everybody. It's Pastor Brian Ross from Grace Life Bible Church in Grand Rapids, Michigan. We want to wish you a happy new year. This is the second day of 2024, and I'm finally getting around to recording my last episode in the series of The Rise and Fall of Dispensationalism. It was my goal to get this done before the end of 2023, and with family being in town and things happening between Christmas and New Year's, it just didn't happen. So I apologize for that. As always, we want to welcome you here to our YouTube channel. If you haven't already done so, if you would consider subscribing and ringing the alarm bells, a way of staying current with the ministry when we go live from our assembly building on Sunday morning, as well as when we create content for you here midweek, we would certainly appreciate that. Also want to remind you about our Rumble channel here. We established this as an alt-text site should something happen to our YouTube ministry. So if you're into alt-text sites or like an alternative to YouTube, please consider checking us out here on Rumble as well. My featured books this week are, once again, my co-authored book with my former professor, Dr. Dale DeWitt, J.C. O'Hare, and the Origins of the American Grace Movement, 1899 to 1958. This is a full-length feature church history book covering an important figure in the history of dispensationalism in the United States and the fountainhead of the American Grace Movement. Also want to remind you about Rightly Dividing E.W. Bullinger, Assessing His Life, Ministry, and Impact. This is a brief sketch of the life of Bullinger with a specific focus on the historical development of the Acts 28 dispensational point of view. So if you're into the history of dispensationalism or would like to know more about these important figures, please consider checking out either a copy of O'Hare and or Bullinger. As I already said, those of you who have been following the channel, you know that since May of 2023, which is now last year, we've been following and going through Daniel G. Hummel's book, The Rise and Fall of Dispensationalism, How the Evangelical Battle Over the End Times Shaped the Nation. And so here is the preview here on Google Books, and we've been going through this. This lesson will be the 26th episode as we work our way towards finishing this material. So where we left off last time is we are in part three, The Pop Dispensationalist, 1960 to 2020. And we are in the last chapter, surveying the aftermath. And as always, there is a brief introduction to the chapter, and then there are four different subsections this time. I'm not going to read everything, just give you some of the high points as we wrap this up. Chapter 19 starts on page 321 of Hummel's book. And so this is how he begins the chapter in the introduction. He says in 2004, the same year the Left Behind novel, the 12th Left Behind novel, appeared on store shelves, the religion scholar Amy Johnson Fickholm, I hope I'm saying that right, published a study titled Rapture Culture. So this is a study about rapture culture that's published, and it just so happens to drop in the same year, 2004, that the final volume, the 12th volume of the Left Behind series, dropped. This particular scholar says, in my mind's eye, she wrote, I see my grandmother's Schofield Reference Bible, a text for which she read every day of her life, a text that told her of the coming rapture. Rapture culture offered insights into the appeal of the rapture fiction and the way, as Fickholm described it on the first page, the Left Behind series brought, quote, dispensationalist premillennialism from the margins of culture into the mainstream. Speaking to a reporter years later, Fickholm sharpened her sense of the theology's ascendancy, saying, quote, I don't think this is a subculture. This may be the dominant American culture, and the rest of us are subcultures. So that is an interesting thing. So what the suggestion that's being made there is that by the time you get to the early 2000s, that the pop dispensationalist emphasis on the end time scenario of dispensationalism, rapture, Antichrist, tribulation, second coming, millennium, that scenario, which we've already discussed in previous episodes, was being taught by pop dispensationalism devoid of its scriptural foundation as to why that was the scenario that dispensational theology was embracing, now has become the dominant culture, according to this particular scholar's analysis. Now, we could debate whether that's true or not. I got my questions about it, but it is an interesting point to consider that by the time you get from 1960 with the late great Planet Earth and Hal Lindsey to the early 2000s, in that time frame, okay, I said 1960, I meant 1970, that 30 years, the pop dispensationalist rapture culture was the dominant culture. That's what this particular scholar is asserting in this piece, rapture culture. Okay. In light of the history of dispensationalism recounted so far, Fricombe's observations were both true and incomplete. And that's kind of what I would say. There's an element of truth, but I don't think that that's a total accurate analysis, just given what we've already seen about the different groups, the new Calvinist group, the Dominionist group that were against dispensational theology, George Eldon Ladd, and then even the recasting of dispensationalism that was happening in the 1990s at Dallas Theological Seminary, and the advent and rise of progressive dispensationalism. Undoubtedly, the popular culture reach of dispensationalism had achieved an apotheosis in the early 21st century. The Left Behind series was the most visible sign of this success, and in many other forms of media, nonfiction books, films, music, the American appetite for, quote, rapture culture seemed insatiable. At the same time, the fate of dispensationalism as a living theological tradition had never been under more threat. The sales success of Left Behind and the broader success of pop dispensationalism was a minor consolation. In 2004, dispensationalism was a movement with no vested national leaders, a scholastic tradition with no young scholars, a commercial behemoth with no internal cohesion. Fricombe's study had made this absolutely clear. She concluded that the Left Behind series was far from, quote, a monolithic force that taught its readers dispensational theology was a multiple dynamic contradictory system with cracks and fissures. That illustrated, quote, just how broad and diffuse evangelicalism is in American culture, end quote. The series had most likely introduced most readers to the concept of the rapture, than anything written since late great Planet Earth, but to what end? The authors, LaHaye and Jenkins, had done little more than toss a fictional account of dispensational eschatology into an ocean of American popular culture. I have to say, I agree with Hummel. This is why I never read or promoted the Left Behind books, because number one, they were not particularly mid-acts in their dispensational point of view, meaning they were teaching things about the dispensational end time schema that I thought were fundamentally flawed and false. So you have now this, so just think this through. You have this massive popular cultural pop dispensational emphasis through the Left Behind series on the end time scenario of dispensationalism. And it's, in my opinion, an unrightly divided schema that's being presented there. Dispensationalism's scholastic collapse in the 1990s did not mean it immediately disappeared. Vast amounts of cultural and institutional influence remained. Whether cognizant of the reality or not, 21st century American evangelicals lived in a religious culture deeply imprinted by the dispensational system whose ideas did not vanish, as Fricombe perceptively documented, but whose theological integrity was laid low. The parts of dispensationalism had been scattered, no longer organized in the service of a seemingly broken system, but pulled into powerful currents of popular culture and politics where they continued to shape and form Christians in powerful ways. So that's the end of the introduction. Okay. This first subsection is called Religious Culture, Popular Dispensational Fumes. Okay. Page 322. They talk here about a couple different works. The Left Behind series reached 80 million in sales into the new century, and the additions of briskly selling dispensational fiction continued. Popular thrillers and apocalyptic novels by Joel Rosenberg, Jamie Lee Gray, and Jonathan Kahn films include Final, The Rapture, 2013, The Remaining, 2014, and Left Behind Eternal Forces, 2006 video game, and then a film reboot
starring Nicolas Cage in 2014, and still another on-screen adaptation featuring Kevin Sorbo nearing completion in 2022. In each of these productions, the theology of dispensationalism hovered in the background, informing plot points and an overall Christian didacticism that encouraged consumers towards the values that align with fundamentalism, even as they freely borrowed, modified, or discarded dispensational theology. So again, I have a hard time arguing with that. I think Hummel's probably right about that. The same dispensational lack of interest in theology was visible in in prophecy analysis as well, which entered the 21st century deeply tied to the new Christian right arguments about society and culture. The Y2K bug illustrated this point. Concerns about Y2K were shared widely across American society, but fears of the ability of computers to respond to the year code changing from 99 to 00, making the year 2000 potentially indistinguishable from 1900, pop dispensationalists were constant promoters of that worry. Jerry Falwell sold several survival food by Hotline and produced a film, A Christian's Guide to the Millennium Bug, and he promoted through the old-time gospel hour. Like the humanist tribulation, which was adapted by all types of new Christian right leaders in the 1980s, Y2K alarmism also appealed to non-dispensational fundamentalists. Okay, then they mentioned D. James Kennedy talking about Y2K, and of course, none of this happens. Okay, so there, it's just another example of pop dispensationalism's leveraging of dispensational concepts, creates a bunch of hullabaloo, gets everybody scared, freaked out. They buy their survival food. They buy all these videos telling people what to do and how to think about the situation, and nothing ultimately happens. Okay, and then, of course, that's the year 1999 going into 2000, and then in September 2001, we have the 9/11 attacks. Okay, which is going to just sort of boost this thing up again. The same context made space for popular dispensational geopolitical analysis in the wake of the terrorist attacks on September 11, 2001. Hal Lindsey, one of the first to capitalize with The Everlasting Hatred, The Roots of Jihad, 2002, which foregrounded radical Islam over the defunct Soviet Union as the most malignant force in the world, prophetically speaking. Lindsey was frank about his evolving views in 2002, explaining, when I wrote, quote, Late, Late, Great Planet Earth in 1969, the Muslim nations were nothing like the threat they are now. Because of Bible prophecy, I recognized that with Russian help, Muslims had to be one of the powerful blocks of the last day. This spirit of adaptability had been anticipated by pop dispensational writers in the 1990s. For example, in John Hagee's Final Dawn Over Jerusalem, 1999, which foregrounded a clash with Islam as the major new horizon in prophecy analysis. Okay. Then they mention books here by Mark Hitchcock, The Coming Invasion of Israel, Mike Evans, that's from 2002, Mike Evans, Beyond Iraq, The Next Move, 2003, with several references to the scholastic tradition, and each featuring an idiosyncratic timeline for the unfolding prophecy. These takes on the post 9/11 situation deepened the already strong suspicion of Islam among new Christian right leaders, and tacitly and explicitly endorsed the war on terror as a prophetically significant struggle. Now, being old enough, I do remember this. I remember watching John Hagee on TV. I remember watching a lot of this stuff unfold. In the next paragraph on 324, Hummel talks about Hagee's book, The Four Blood Moons, in 2013. He talks about some stuff that he talks about David Jeremiah's book titled The Book of Signs, 2020, and how a bunch of this stuff is influencing how the American Christian right, so to speak, is interpreting things. Okay, what united these authors was not shared seminary training or broader denominational heritage, nor was it regional or social proximity. Rather, it was decades of engagement in conservative political organizations and causes on the part of the authors. There were no theological gatekeepers for pop dispensationalism, but there remained a uniformity of political and cultural prescriptions curated by a new Christian right that continued to exhibit pop dispensational sensibility. So this really is the point of the book, okay? Because the new Christian right, as Hummel is saying, is fundamentally, in his opinion, as we've heard him say in the past, Christian nationalism. And this is all being distilled through this pop dispensational lens across a swath of American evangelicalism, which is now shaping the goals and aims of the political right in the United States. This is really the focal point of much of what Hummel is arguing in the book. Okay. Still on page 324, there's a couple other things here that are interesting. Let's see here. What mattered was not the exploration of relevant data. What mattered was that the exploration of relevant data was entertaining. The predictions reinforced the existing political and cultural commitments, and that the host was authentic in his convictions about righteousness, the rightness of his predictions. So they're talking about all of these prognostications that are going on through this pop dispensationalism. Okay. And then on page 325, he gets to the election of Trump in 2016. Okay. The humanist tribulation, already detached from the theology that shaped it, moved even further into political and cultural currents of the new Christian right with the election of Donald Trump in 2016. A prime example was the best-selling The Trump Prophecies, 2017. The subtitle read, Astonishing True Story of the Man Who Saw Tomorrow and What He Says Is Coming Next. The man was author Mark Taylor, an ex-firefighter who claimed as early as 2011 to have experienced visions of a Trump presidency that essentially would reverse the humanist tribulation and re-Christianize America. Taylor had no seminary training and was largely discredited outside certain new Christian right circles, but his book listed routinely as a bestseller on Amazon and a film version, The Trump Prophecy 2018, was produced in collaboration with Liberty University's Cinematic Arts Program. In the 19th century, new premillennialism had erected an entire institutional complex to create its distinctive religious subculture. Now new premillennialists were never apolitical, but they were oriented towards a different end goal than political power. We've seen this, okay? We've seen this. I've talked about it. I mentioned it a lot if you go back through the previous episodes in this series. The overarching aim of the new premillennial complex was global missions, a project embedded in American power, but it was also otherworldly in the most literal sense of the term. The kingdom for which new premillennialists evangelized lay across a metaphysical chasm that they, almost uniquely in the history of Christianity, place entirely outside the present world. Pursuing such a mission, generation after generation required a particular set of institutions and commitments dedicated to the success. The premillennial complex of the early 20th century was deeply compromised by the end of the century. Theological tensions at the heart of fundamentalist factionalism had led to the decisive crack-up in the 1970s that paved the way for a rival complex based on the goals of cultural and political power. The materials for the structure were not new, but they were evident in the nationalist faction of the fundamentalist movement, in the fundamentalist embrace of anti-communism, in the dispensational insistence that theology and political commitments walk hand-in-hand. But unlike the premillennial complex of the early 20th century, the new complex assumed very little of an otherworldly agenda. Its chief patrons were just as easily and eagerly classified as consumers as they were Christians, as voters as they were missionaries. Every twist on the 20th century pop dispensationalism had some precedent in the 20th century, but not until the collapse of scholastic dispensationalism in the 1990s did the center of gravity shift decisively to the new political and cultural project, centered on the institutions of the new Christian right and religious media. By the 21st century, this political, cultural, pop dispensational complex had become entirely autonomous from scholastic discourse in many ways from established religious institutions of any type. This is, okay, this is an interesting analysis, and it's hard for people to read stuff like this, myself included to some degree, and separate it from what I think, okay? So I vote a certain way based upon my understanding of what the Bible teaches, not because I'm trying to bring about some sort of political endgame. So I vote my conscience according to Scripture, evaluating the different planks in the political platforms of the options that I have. Okay? What Hummel is suggesting here is that by the time you get to the election of Donald Trump in 2016, that pop dispensationalism was inseparable and the driving force behind this new Christian right, this Christian nationalism, as we've seen him say in the past. Subsection 2. Subsection 2. Sorry for that bit of awkwardness there. I had an unanticipated technical problem that I had to figure out, so I'm sorry about that. Popular culture entertaining a premillennial nation. American culture in the 21st century was awash with pop dispensational motifs, okay? This is page 326. In concert with other trends of the era, pop dispensationalism supplied Americans with an essentially premillennial vision of the future. Though rarely was the term of its theological context overt. Rather, Americans of many backgrounds assumed a secularized premillennial expectation of declining social cohesion and rising existential threats that would end in an era of defining catastrophe. Okay, now look, I just preached Sunday on this message here, 2024 and the fourth turning. Okay, I'll say more about that at the end. So the 21st century, countless films, television shows, and video games borrowed from pop dispensational end times imagery and vocabulary. This is the End, 2013, Rapture Palooza, 2013. These are just sort of comedies. Dispensational concepts were used more for dramatic effect in the HBO series The Leftovers, 2014 to 2017, based on a novel by the same title. Central plot device in the series was the sudden disappearance of 2% of the world's population. Neither of the two creative minds behind the show was an adherent to dispensationalism. Pop dispensationalism, Rapture flipped the script, he explained to a journalist, and he pondered a story in which only a small number of random humans disappeared with no explanation. In The Leftovers, it looked like the Rapture, but it wasn't the Rapture. It didn't choose Christians over anybody else. So there we have a clear cultural sort of bastardization, if you will, of the Rapture concept, almost making fun of it. Okay, the book and series won awards. So the Hummel's point is this is how embedded into the popular culture pop dispensationalism was by this point. The fact that HBO is making a miniseries with a spinoff of a Rapture concept called The Leftovers, and it's saying certain people disappeared, but it's not being specific about who, what, or why, or without any dispensational sort of concept. He talks about the Marvel movies in phase three of the franchise, which encompassed 11 films from 2016 to 2019 that grossed more than $13 billion. He talks about Snap. The Snapture is the term, okay? This is from the movie The Infinity Gauntlet. In Phase 3, Avengers Endgame, the highest grossing film in history at the time, began in the aftermath of, quote, the Snapture. The first minutes of the movie were essentially a classic Rapture scene, while a follow-up television series pondered the classic Rapture quandary on where the Select went when they disappeared. The Infinity Gauntlet plot dated and ran in the early 1990s comics, but the success of the Marvel movies made the Rapture motif one of the most inidentifiable one of the most identifiable, in all of cinema. Just as with other examples of pop dispensational diffusion, the Marvel Universe had no traceable connection to religious institutions, and its use of, quote, the snapture could be discussed entirely without reference to dispensationalism. So again, Hummel's point is this is how crazy and diffused pop dispensationalism had become in American popular culture. Speaking about the snapture, he mentions some stuff about biblical lore. Then he talks about the video game, Everyone's Gone in the Rapture, 2015. He talks about other examples from television shows, from a host of different sources. And then he ends the subsection by saying, all told, the dispersion of dispensational ideas, especially the shape of its premillennial telos and its unique eschatological concepts, reached dizzying cultural heights in the 21st century. The success shaped Americans' religious beliefs too, at least when judged by polling data. A 2004 Newsweek poll indicated that 55% of Americans agreed that faithful believers will be taken up in heaven in the rapture. This was evidence everywhere that the rapture was more popular in the first decades of the 21st century than ever before, and yet the scholastic health of dispensationalism had already flatlined. And I'm saying, since the release of Hummel's book and things I've been seeing on YouTube, the rapture concept and dispensational theology itself are being openly ridiculed and mocked, even by former grace teachers who are no longer, you know, rightly dividing the word of truth or no longer identifying themselves as mid-acts dispensationalists, okay? And then this third subsection is political culture and the ends of the internet. And this just talks now about how all of this spills over into debate and discussion, okay? Alongside its religious and popular reach, popular dispensationalism also advanced a complicated legacy on the internet. In the message boards that perpetuated fundamentalist theological conflict, in the apocalyptic conspiracy theories that pulse through online communities and real-world politics, and in the social media-fueled popularization that came to define American society in the 21st century. In each arena, imprints of new Christian right, politics, and pop dispensational culture worked in tandem and interlocked in both predictable and novel ways. They talk here, the popular study platforms like Logos Bible Software were built on digital Bible databases, including CD World Library Project of Dallas Theological Seminary. Logos built a massive library of ebooks and eventually counted more than 200,000 titles, including hundreds of study Bibles and translations, and most of the entire corpus of new premillennial and scholastic dispensational theology, from the collected works of John Nelson Darby and Lewis Berry Chaper to Chuck Swindoll's entire New Testament commentary, to back issues of the obscure mid-century theological journals. Logos empowered pastors and lay researchers in ways that the first promoters of biblical concordances could have only dreamed of. In other corners of the internet, there were fundamentalists debated theology. Christian Reconstructionists, New Calvinists, and ex-dispensationalists continue to hammer on dispensational weaknesses. This is absolutely true. This is what is happening right now. They talk about in 2011 the Puritan board thread titled, Am I a Dispensationalist? Hummel talks about that. On page 330, he's got a paragraph here on anti-dispensationalism was present in numerous blogs and resource libraries from the Reformed Forum, an educational organization linked to the International Council of Reformed Churches, to the theological debates and blog mongerism, I've never heard of it, which compiled dozens of critical works and videos. Separatist fundamentalists targeted dispensationalism too, such as the YouTube controversialist and independent Baptist Stephen Anderson, who produced multiple documentaries after the tribulation 2016 and Marching Towards Zion 2017. He talks about the new Calvinism and the reach of megachurch pastor Mark Driscoll, ballooned online. At the same time, dispensational theology shrunk. Driscoll's pioneering online preaching was one example, as was the fast expansion of the Gospel Coalition website, becoming one of the largest web publishing platforms in American religion. By design, by the beginning of the 21st century, New Calvinism had positioned itself as the heir of the evangelical social thought. For the rank and file laity, as once occupied by new Christian right leaders such as Falwell and LaHaye, and long ago by world system critiques and the heads of the Moody movement, New Calvinists advanced models of biblical manhood and womanhood that that defaulted to 20th century cultural norms and family values. So they're talking about this influence and how this is going to influence the new Christian right, the new Calvinism. This was undoubtedly a continuation of similar efforts under pop dispensationalism, new Christian right leadership, albeit in a much more theologically sophisticated formulas. The continuity between pop dispensationalism and new Calvinist leadership circles revealed deep contours that span the breadth of white evangelicalism in the 21st century. Even so, this homogeneity existed alongside and amid seismic shifts that continued to reshape the evangelical community. As a declining theological tradition, scholastic dispensationalism had few online hubs that could revive the energy and content production of Reformed covenantal critics. I think that's true. Outside of local churches like Grace Life Bible Church and others that I'm familiar with, a lot of this stuff doesn't really happen. He talks about, on page 331, he talks about some other things related to pop dispensationalism, Liberty University. The political rather than the theological core of these sites indicated what united pop dispensationalists after 2010, a shared loathing of liberalism, progressivism, and modernism. So the idea there is that that becomes the primary focus. The legacy of pop dispensationalism was more visible at the convergence of the new Christian right and the internet, which had merged to aid Donald Trump's presidential election in 2015-2016 and provided his most loyal base of support even after his defeat in 2020. By the 2010s, pop dispensationalism was feeding into a resurgent Christian nationalist movement that continued to see itself as the rightful stewards of American culture. Christian nationalists rallied around a series of causes, the anti-bailout Tea Party after the 2008 banking crisis, the 2013 birtherism controversy, questioning the legitimacy of the presidency of Barack Obama, and the QAnon conspiracy, which began in 2017. Each episode had trace elements of pop dispensational influence. Combining many of these substrata of white evangelical culture was the QAnon conspiracy, which began on the edges and avowedly non-religious 4chan internet culture, but soon gained a following that was disproportionately represented by those most likely to be influenced by pop dispensationalism, namely white evangelicals. In the nearly 5,000 posts by the mysterious QAnon from 2017 to 2020 were dozens of biblical passages and predictions, Q drops, related to the political fortunes of Donald Trump. There was no dominant apocalyptic motif in these posts, but the general outlines of the humanist tribulation were simply assumed. The revelations of Q heralded a, quote, great awakening led by Donald Trump that would beat back a vast conspiracy of liberals, progressives, secularists, and other enemies of the American people. A vague deliverance, possibly supernatural, lay at the end of the quote, storm, Q's terms for the coming tribulation. Much of the coverage of QAnon on the wild details of the conspiracy, deep state child sex trafficking, and the and satanic rituals, but more cogent to its appeals was the pattern of history that Q endorsed, tribulation, awakening, and deliverance. By the 2010s, this was a pattern structuring the political identity of the new Christian right far more than a generation via politicized and commercialized pop dispensationalism and mediated through the media and political messaging. A more precise metaphor in light of the fall of dispensationalism was that QAnon jumped the tracks at the spot where pop dispensationalists had departed scholastic dispensationalism a generation earlier, with both careening into folk religious landscape defined by anarchism of the internet and the illogic of culture wars. So again, we see that I think this is probably one of the greatest takeaways of Hummel's book is these political observations that he seems to be making here. Okay. By 2021, polling indicated that white evangelicals were overrepresented among QAnon followers. And he ends this section by saying, from the rise of electronic Bible software to the dark corners in the internet message boards, the legacy of dispensationalism was scattered across the digital landscape. With the system compromised, the constituent parts mixed into other movements and contexts, pop dispensationalism was one manifestation of many of the long theological tradition that extended back nearly 200 years, but more immediately, the proliferation of pop dispensationalism kept the theology relevant in the landscape of American media. Okay. And then we have the last subsection, Tony Campolo, Deconstructing Dispensationalism. Page 333. A telltale sign of dispensationalism's fate was its exclusion from the vital movements in evangelicalism in the early 20th century. The new Calvinists, the emergent church, the prosperity gospel, the evangelical left, the evangelical community, and many other pockets besides all derided, ignored, and excluded dispensationalists. So, again, not being a part of some of those things, I'm sort of left to kind of take Hummel's word for that and question whether or not that's the case. But on page 334, he talks about Tony Campolo. Prominent critics of conservative evangelicalism, such as Tony Campolo, a sociologist pastor and leader of the evangelical left, typified the way dispensationalism was represented in 21st century evangelical discourse. In a 2003 speech to moderate Baptists who had left the Southern Baptist Convention, he blamed much of the denomination's dysfunction on, quote, dispensationalism, a weird little form of fundamentalism that started like 150 years ago, directing his anger at the new Calvinist stronghold of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. Campolo scoffed that the school was, quote, has now enshrined Calvin. The comment was confusing. In fact, there were very few, if any, faculty at Southern Seminary who would have been counted as dispensationalists in 2003. But it was revealing that Campolo made the charge anyway. By the year 2000, dispensationalism was nothing if not shorthanded for sectarian fundamentalism, an ironic legacy given to its leaders longing to avoid this very fate. As white evangelicalism continued to debate and separate itself over issues of justice, race, politics, and culture, the significance of dispensationalism had changed with it. Rather than a set of theological doctrines, dispensationalism had come to mean a certain perspective on politics. Okay? A certain perspective on politics. That whole sense of rapture, which may occur at any moment, is used as a device to oppose engagement with the principalities, the powers, the political economic structures of our age. A vivid, though unwitting, channeling of Philip Morrow's original critiques close to a century earlier. And then he ends the chapter here. The dire straits of scholastic dispensationalism were evident in the prominence of Hal Lindsey and Tim LaHaye and the traditional as the tradition's foremost representatives. They had ushered dispensationalism into the center of American popular culture, pioneered its reconstructioning around culture and politics, and acted as agents of its dispersion into virtually every form of media and the center of the new Christian right. By the 21st century, they had a strong claim to the legacy of dispensationalism as anyone else, as strong a claim. One significant change over the century that bridged Dwight Moody and Tony Campolo was the extension of premillennial categories from overtly religious contexts, such as revivals and missions agencies, to the popular forms that deposited bits of dispensationalism into mainstream culture and political discourse. The success of pot dispensationalism, as Tony Campolo inadvertently revealed in his catalog of recent New Christian Right political victories, was that its motifs and messages had been severed from the theological system to which it had once been attached. Campolo's charge against Southern Seminary was both misdirected, few dispensationalists worked at the institution, and insufficient. Pop dispensationalism had very little to do with contemporary theological discourse. The end time scenarios of the authors used in their novels and the prophetic timelines that many pastors still referenced in their sermons advanced a humanist tribulation threat and a new Christian right kingdom fashioned not by theologians, but by the theologically uninterested or illiterate. That ends the chapter. And I'm telling you, the dispensationalism that I hold to and embrace is not anything like the dispensationalism that Hummel is reacting to when he talks about pop dispensationalism. But this is the problem now, okay? When people now go against and they want to argue against dispensationalism, they want to argue against the rapture, they're arguing against this sort of straw man version of dispensationalism, if you will, that is stripped bare and naked from its exegetical, biblical, theological skeleton that supported and gave credence to its end time scenario and has now been sort of co-opted into all these different sort of elements of popular culture. And if you didn't catch it, Hummel is very clearly laying the current politics of our situation at the feet of dispensationalism and saying that it's dispensationalism is the primary factor in the rise of Trump, the new Christian right, QAnon conspiracyism, and so forth. I don't think I'm reading too much into it because that seems to be the point of the book. After all, the book is titled The Rise and Fall of Dispensationalism, How the Evangelical Battle Over the End Times Shaped the Nation. So I think there are elements in Hummel's book that are both true. There are elements in his book that I think are false or that I'm not convinced by. Because I think the book is ultimately driving towards this analysis that he's ending with, that the cause of the current situation that we find ourselves in is the result and fault of dispensational theology. He says one more interesting thing in the epilogue, which I think is an important point to think about. He says the unwillingness of many dispensationalists to understand their own commitments in historical terms makes their story all the more tragic, but their contributions no less substantial. I will say that as I have gone through the Grace History Project and I've gone through some of these things, I think there has been an extreme lack on the part of dispensationalists to understand historical theology, to understand the thought developments and how these things influence and impact one another. If you think about the way Hummel wrote the book, he is approaching this from a very sort of historiography lens, where he's taking the historical things that have been written, produced, recorded, broadcasted, etc., and he's sort of laying them out on the table in chronological order and evaluating them. That's a process that we know and the historians refer to as historiography. And I do think there's been a very big lack on the part of dispensational people to really understand things from a historical point of view. And that brings me sort of to where I want to end this. This past Sunday, on the last day of 2023, I preached this message 2024 and the Fourth Turning, A Believer's Guide for Understanding and Surviving the Current Crisis. Strauss and Howe published The Fourth Turning in 1997 and forecasted, based upon an understanding of the cycles of American history, not as biblical prophets, not as scriptural prophets, but looking at the trends of history, the cycles that have occurred in the life cycle of the American nation. And they forecasted that sometime between 2005 and 2025, that America was going to walk through a crisis point that would fundamentally reshape and remake the nation. It's my personal belief and conviction that that's sort of where we are right now as we enter into 2024. And so I offer some thoughts. I present a scriptural model of history and try to encapsulate some things for your thinking as we enter into this new year, a time which I believe will be a time of upheaval. I also want to let you know that my wife and I just released a new episode of our podcast. We released this yesterday on the new year, January 1st, 2024, and it's Happy New Year recap of 2023 and what's coming up for the podcast. So we want to get back into that. It's hard to keep a regular schedule with everything that we have going on. But if you want to check that out, I'll leave a link in the description for this video, as well as a link in the description for my message from yesterday, 2024, and the Fourth Turning. So that brings us then to the end of our analysis for now of Hummel's book. I'm not saying that I won't have further things to say about this in the future, because I think this is an important book in the history of dispensational thought, discourse, that people need to think about and take seriously because of the sort of viewpoint that Hummel is putting out. Since I bought this book, I've purchased some other ones that are kind of, I don't want to say directly opposing or responding to Hummel, but certainly take a different track than the one presented by Hummel as far as the historical development of dispensational theology and how dispensational theology concepts have been taught at many different places throughout the history of the dispensation of grace. I went over some of those books very early in this series, so I would encourage you, if you want to know more about that, to go back and check some of the earlier episodes when I first discussed that. So I appreciate your time and your patience as I've gone through this information. If you want to know more about dispensational history, I would encourage you to check out the Grace History Project. I'll leave a link in the description for this video for that as well. I want to wish everybody a happy new year, and I want to remind everybody that the only way that you can have eternal life as a free gift is to trust Jesus Christ, his death, his burial, his resurrection, as the only total complete payment for your sin. You need to trust Jesus Christ today before it's everlasting too late. God loves you. Christ died for your sin. He sent his son to shed his blood for you on the cross to make satisfaction, to satisfy the offended justice of God against sin, so that he can offer you eternal life as a free gift. Your church going, your works, your performance, your law keeping, whatever you're doing that you think is going to make you right before God, it's only going to leave you short of the glory of God. Trust Jesus Christ today. Rely exclusively in his death, burial, resurrection as the only total complete payment for your sin. Trust Christ today before it's everlasting too late. Thanks for your attention, and we'll see you next time.